show by any means necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today, a little later in the show, we're going to be talking with G. Yamazawa about his new album and some of the role of arts in culture and our current situation. And also, of course, we're going to start with, before we move on, the story we'll be talking about throughout the show today, which is the Trump-Russia Oval Office situation. And somehow, just when you thought it couldn't, the entire Trump administration-Russia saga, on top of everything else, took another crazy turn, as President Trump has now confirmed in last week's meeting with Sergey Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, and other Russian officials, the president revealed a piece of classified information regarding the increased threat of laptop bombings on airplanes from the Islamic State, at least the perception of this by U.S. intelligence agencies and their allies. Trump's admission, following an exclusive story in the Washington Post that quickly rocketed around the world, has raised all sorts of new questions. Of course, for those who already think Trump is some sort of Russian agent, this stands as something like a final confirmation. For Trump's defenders, well, it poses more or less no problem. And for those taking a more sober view of the whole Russiagate saga, it's another moment for patient explanation. And the story is now being complicated by a thinly sourced story coming from Fox News that the murdered DNC staffer Seth Rich did leak the DNC documents to WikiLeaks, which some are using to buttress claims that that aspect and the leak and all of that is part of this widespread assault on Trump by powerful forces trying to box him in. The issues with the leak itself, though, have been raised on a number of different levels. The most straightforward is that the information Trump revealed was provided by an ally and that the big reveal was not cleared with them, and thus it may hurt intelligence cooperation with that country, whomever it may be. Apparently, also that country had already expressed frustrations with the feelings that the U.S. couldn't secure classified information. So who knows if they'll be mad or whatever it may be, but that may be the one clear and unambiguous unforced error on Trump's part and revealing this, but ostensibly, he also expected the conversation would be kept secret, an issue that we'll come back to. And it's now being reported by the New York Times that Israel is the source of that, which would make sense, given that the Israelis are highly engaged in the region and had complained in the past about fears of Trump not being able to keep things secret. The second big issue was whether or not Trump's revelation has hurt U.S. intelligence gathering in the region. That ultimately is difficult to really parse, since almost everything in the Post story was just allusions to information, which they refused to reveal, allegedly at the behest of intelligence agencies. Trump and National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster say there was no reveal of so-called sources and methods, just a discussion of specific threats around the laptop ban on airplanes issue. The Post article and its anonymous sources claim the opposite, in particular that Trump revealed the exact city the informant was in, and that apparently really hurts U.S. intelligence collection. Although that claim has some nuance to it, though, because Russia is also opposed to the Islamic State, so perhaps it could help Russia try to maybe find and buy out this informant and use it for their own purposes, but it seems hard to understand how it would hurt the fight against the Islamic State. So ultimately, what you feel about this issue sort of depends on what you think about U.S. foreign policy. If you think it's all great and benign and for the service of good and in the democracy, then this might be bad. Now, if you generally feel that U.S. intelligence agencies are just a part and parcel of the world policeman role of U.S. imperialism, which is the key source of the massive conflict in the Middle East anyways, as well as all sorts of other situations that make the world seem like it's laced with dynamite, then yeah, you probably aren't shedding a lot of tears for the CIA. So how you feel about that one, as well as the reveal of the U.S. allies' intelligence, is really a worldview question. Do you think the U.S. government is benign or positive actor on the world stage or not? Since we have no idea which side of this is really telling the whole truth on this particular point, that's the only view one can take, an interpretation based on your view of the players. Now, the third point that has been raised is whether or not this is a sign of Trump being some sort of agent of Russia. Now, that seems like a bit of a stretch, just like most other things that have been used to allege that. But to really put it in context, we have to consider the context of the laptop ban issue. Now, Trump had already put in place a rule that flights coming from 10 Muslim majority countries, basically, that the laptops, you can't have them as checked. You got to put them in your – you can't have them as a carry-on. You got to put them in your checked baggage. The thought is that it's easier to detonate a lithium battery bomb in your hands than remotely in the cargo hold. The overall possibility of lithium battery fires is obviously a threat if you put all the laptops in the cargo hold. Now, these issues became a bigger issue because Trump suggested extending that ban to Europe. The European Union did not like that. And EU officials also were demanding, and it started on Friday, that the Homeland Security head John Kelly go to Europe to explain more directly why they should do this, why they should accept this at all. So both European and Middle Eastern countries and airlines have been warning that the laptop issue could, and to some degree was, in terms of these Middle Eastern airlines, having a major impact on global travel and commerce and wasn't necessary from a security standpoint. So in that context of a significant global pushback on Trump's plans regarding the laptop issue, the disclosure to the Russians has a different significance. It makes sense in the context of trying to develop coordination with Russia on the fight against ISIS that the president would then explain to them why he was pursuing a policy that seemed to be pissing off all of America's closest allies over laptops being allowed as carry-ons. It's possible he was pushing back maybe against something Russians said in support of that stance against Trump's laptop ban. And it's also possible he was offering the information as a show of good faith, as a basically, hey, I'm saying we could cooperate. People are saying I'm crazy to do this laptop thing. Let me tell you what I got, why I'm doing it, and since I'm sharing it with you, you know that I'm serious about this collaboration. Now, you could say whether you think that's right or whether it was wrong, reckless or not, but just to say that this is some sort of sign that Russia controls America seems like a bit of a stretch based on anonymous sources, which is always dangerous. Which brings us to the final point, which is the information being leaked in the first place. Now, it seems entirely clear that this leak was designed purely to hurt Donald Trump and his presidency. Because if the issue is national security, more has been revealed by the leak to the Post than by Trump's conduct in the Oval Office. Now, everyone knows at least something about U.S. quote-unquote sources and methods as it concerns the Islamic State. And really, we can infer quite a bit from that story. Enough that undoubtedly a spy hunt is on by various sides to learn more. And whoever the source is almost certainly in danger. How many people really know the Islamic State's most intimate plans? It really cannot be that many, and undoubtedly ISIS is trying to track this person down now, which could also lead to many of those suspected of being the source to be killed, even if they aren't. It's also clear that Trump's own team, well, at least one member, Thomas Bossert, felt somewhat uncomfortable with what took place, placing calls to the CIA and the NSA afterwards and what is being spun as some sort of damage control by the media and a, quote, overabundance of caution by McMaster. So someone in that chain, it appears, leaked the information, although, of course, anything is possible given that there are a number of people in the meeting or that perhaps could have gleaned knowledge from a participant. But again, it seems clear that whoever leaked it to the media was trying to hurt Trump, which almost certainly will escalate Trump's war on leaks to new heights. Senator Lindsey Graham has also come out today expressing anger at the voluminous leaks coming from the White House pretty much since day one. The president and his allies seem to think there is a conspiracy of the intelligence community and pro-Obama bureaucrats seeking to undermine them. Undoubtedly now the bunker mentality is going to intensify, and it seems like quite a bit of the Republican legislative agenda could become bogged down. Clearly the government is locked into something of a crisis over the issues swirling around Trump and Russia. Can't really conduct business outside of the shadow of this story, and this is why I will renew the call made on this show before more than once to have this entire investigation brought out from behind the shadows. Quite a bit of information needs to be declassified and released, and someone other than the major media working with anonymous sources and the government and their intelligence agencies can have some ability to assess the veracity or lack thereof or context of the wide-ranging claims being slung around with great consequence. A new Human Rights Watch report has revealed that former President Barack Obama's deportation policy was worse than we thought. Obama has earned this distinction of deporting the most people of any president, but he tried to cover that by saying he was primarily trying to focus on criminals and certainly not separating families. Human Rights Watch, though, has a new report out about Obama's immigration, looking particularly at California, and it found 42% of the immigrants ICE detained in California over that time period that they were studying were parents of U.S. citizens. U.S. citizen children, after being detained, parents of American citizens were more likely than others to be deported. More likely than others. Close to 47% of those who were deported had a child with U.S. citizenship versus 35% of those who were released. The report is more extensive, and people who are interested should definitely take a look. But ultimately, the issue here is that really from Bill Clinton through Donald Trump, immigration enforcement has become more brutal and far more militarized. And those were today's talking points. And you are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear. And as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By any means necessary.
And we're very happy to be joined here to continue our conversation on this issue of Trump and Russia and the Oval Office by Ray McGovern, who's a former CIA analyst and political activist. Ray, thank you so much for joining the show.
You're most welcome, Gene.
And so I think the biggest issue here in some ways, to me, I guess, that's not really being discussed. Everyone's saying, well, Trump did X, Y, Z, but the reason why he did it is very important to me. I think anyone for the story. Now, of course, those who already believe that Trump is a Kremlin agent, this is just more, you know, grist for that mill. But it also seems to me, and I'm curious from your thoughts here, and of course, you are someone who has briefed presidents with classified information, that Trump also could have been making a strategic calculation that revealing this information to the Russians could have been a sign of good faith in their collaboration.
Well, Gene, that makes a good bit of sense. You know, the one area where, under the surface of things, we have been cooperating with the Russians is Syria. Now, the Russians didn't much care for those Tomahawk missiles pouring into Syria, but Trump did warn them ahead of time, and they did very little damage. And in my view, the Russians got some good practice shooting some of them down. So for them, it was hardly a terrible, terrible episode. What has transpired since is that the Russians, the Turks, and the Iranians have created these zones within Syria that have a realistic prospect of isolating the really bad guys from the jihadists like ISIS and al-Qaeda. So we've been working with them on that. We even sent a delegate to Astana in Kazakhstan, where this was worked out most recently. And so the question would be, is Trump willing to deal with the Russians on Syria? Because that would be a real token of progress in U.S.-Russian relations. So when we're talking here about all this other stuff, about whether he would deliberately talk to the Russians about some sensitive material, well, we're sort of in no man's land because we don't know what he said. Your explanation is quite plausible. But without knowing what he said, we're all sort of whistling in the dark. What interests me most of all is this. Number one, there's a full-out campaign to get rid of Trump by one means or another. Right now, it's a completely dishonest media campaign painting him out to be an agent of Russia, without any evidence, by the way. And number two, who are these anonymous people that called Greg Miller and said, hey, we got a real story for you. If you're quick, we could put it up this afternoon. You could make a lead story out of it. And indeed, if you look at the Washington Post today, it's a banner headline. Like it goes from the left edge of the first page to the right edge of the first page. That's usually reserved for war or stuff like that. See? So the Post is being totally dishonest. And the question is, who leaked this information to the Post and why? And the only sensible conclusion that I can come up with, it's part and parcel of the CIA and the deep state. Determination to get rid of Trump by blackening him in any way they can. Until somebody can tell me different, that's how I interpret this. And the issue is really joined here. I mean, who is Pompeo, the head of the CIA, working for? Now, if he's Trump, if he's really in the Trump camp, he can find out about this stuff. He can find out how it was that the DNC, in my view, was hacked. Now, hold on to your hat here. That the DNC was hacked by John Brennan's CIA. Now, I can't prove that 100%, but I do know that the New York Times has suppressed the information that CIA, under John Brennan, had developed this incredibly sophisticated program costing billions, like with a B, of dollars, worked out with NSA over a period of 15 years to do what? To hack into servers and computers, to disguise the origin of the hack. And indeed, working in five languages, Russian, Chinese, Arabic, Farsi, and Korean, to be able to insert little telltale signs deceiving any outfit trying to figure out what happened into thinking that, oh, well, you know, if it was Cyrillic, a computer firm like CrowdStrike might deduce, those Russians, they're so expert, but they left behind these telltale signs, Cyrillic, in this hack of the DNC. What am I saying here? I'm saying that Pompeo can find out if he's a real loyalist to Trump. Who did this? Why they did it? And who leaked this information to Greg Miller of the Washington Post? So that issue is joined. Will he do that? I don't know. I don't know whether Pompeo is working for the deeper state or whether he's working for Trump. If he's working for Trump, Trump has the goods on all these guys. And the last thing I'll say on this aspect is that these guys, and I'm talking CIA, I'm talking NSA, I'm talking Comey and the rest of them, they know that the goods is out there if Pompeo wants to use it. And so, in a very meaningful sense, this whole thing, this hysteria of this last week, can betoken a preemptive measure to prevent or to put Trump in such a bad position, nobody will believe him when he says anything, even if he says, hey, guys, guess what I found out? Nobody from Russia hacked into the DNC. It was our own guys. It was John Brennan. This is how they did it, okay? Now, the last thing I would say is that we know now, at least I know now, or I'm persuaded now, that the so-called hack into the DNC was not a hack. It was a leak. What's the difference? A hack goes over the system, goes over the network. NSA intercepts everything that goes over the network, including knowledge of the sender and the receiver. If this was a hack, if the Russians hacked into the DNC and sent it over the network to Julian Assange or to one of his friends, NSA would know that. What's a leak? A leak is where you take a thumb drive or some other medium like that, you stick it in the computer itself. It doesn't go over the network. It goes onto the thumb drive. You give that to somebody who gives it to Julian Assange or one of his people. That's what happened. Now, we know that from the former technical director of the NSA. His name is Bill Binney. And we wrote about that. On the 5th of January of this year, the Baltimore Sun printed an op-ed by both of us, me and by Benny, and it said, look, we know from the technical end of this issue that it had to be a leak and not a hack, and here's the difference, so we explain that. Now, we are now confirmed in our judgment by the fact that this young Democratic National Committee worker, Seth Rich, who was killed, he was plugged by two people in the back on the 10th of July last year. He was working for the DNC. It was a very strange robbery because they didn't take anything from him. And guess what? Now there are well-sourced reports that on his computer there were thousands of messages exchanged with a person associated with WikiLeaks.
Had done it. Well, we're going to have to take a quick break here, but we're going to come back with more on this issue, Ray. So stay with us and with our audience. Stay with us here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear. Stay with us.
By Any Means Necessary.
Back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are continuing our conversation about this whole issue with Trump and Russia and the Oval Office and what maybe or maybe not was revealed. And we continue to be joined by Ray McGovern, who's a former CIA analyst and also a political activist. And Ray, we left off on this issue of Seth Rich, and you had mentioned this is a new report coming out from this morning. Fox News has it. They say that they have a federal investigator that has corroborated for them the news that the FBI is in, does allegedly have the forensic report with quite a number of emails between Mr. Rich and WikiLeaks. It looks like it's perhaps through some sort of third party, an investigative reporter who's living in London. So either way, that's another sort of piece of this story that is surfacing and coming around. And I think that you're, you know, very, very right. And I think many people have suggested it looks more like a leak. And I guess we'll see what happens. But, you know, the other issue that to me, I think is relevant here, and you touched on this, is it seems a little bit irresponsible for the Washington Post to even really run with this story. And that's been my problem with a lot of this stuff from the Post and the New York Times from the beginning, is they're taking these anonymous sources. Then they're saying these anonymous sources told us these major bombshell stories, but we can't reveal any details of the story or who the person was. You basically just have to trust us. And it just sort of seems like, what basis does anyone have to sort of believe the particulars of these particular stories without even more knowledge or information? So it just seems like the press is playing a role here that is, if not directly collusive, certainly enabling of whoever is leaking this information anonymously.
Well, Gene, I think you're absolutely right. What I call the fawning corporate media, including the New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, are part of the deep state. The Post and the Times do not publish things that the CIA or the White House tells them not to publish. And conversely, they do publish things that are unofficially, anonymously leaked. That's about as, it's a prostitution of the journalism profession. It's scandalous, and one cannot depend on the mainstream media for accurate news, whether it's, you know, the newspapers or at evening when you go home and you watch TV news in the evening. So that leads us into a really parlous situation. It's worse. Now, I served in the Soviet Union, and I, you know, before computers, I had to read Pravda and Izvestia every morning. Those are the two major party newspapers. And, the propaganda was bad. But you know what? There was a big difference, Gene. The Russians knew how to read between the lines. They knew that it was propaganda. Unfortunately, the contrast lies in the fact that Americans don't know enough to recognize what's pure propaganda, what's pure purposive deception of the American people. And so they go along with what the mainstream media says. They don't know any better. Now, that has to do with a lot of things, which we won't go into here. What does that mean? Well, that means before the war of aggression against Iraq, and that's the only proper label for it, when the UK and the US invaded Iraq on the 19th of March 2003, 69% of the American people believed that Saddam Hussein, president of Iraq, played a role in 9/11. A masterful deception of the American people, 69%. Now, what would you guess, Gene, would be the percentage of people who believe that Donald Trump owes his presidency to, quote, interference, end quote, by the Russians? What would you say?
Well, I mean, it's got to be, at this stage of the game, still, I don't know, 40, 50, 60% of people.
Yeah, I would guess even higher. There are probably some polls out there. We should look into them. So what do you have here? You have a situation where most people, especially people my age, and I'm pretty old, don't know how to use a computer to get accurate news. That's why programs like yours and Loud and Clear and other programs are so vital. People can find out what's going on. Now, as an example of all this, let me just go back to finish up on Seth Rich. Now, when he was killed, a very bizarre thing happened. Just days later, Julian Assange, head of WikiLeaks, had an interview with, I believe it was a Dutch TV firm. And this is what he said. The killing of Seth Rich indicates the risks that whistleblowers take. And in order to find out who the culprit was, WikiLeaks is willing to offer, I think it was £10,000, $10,000, to whoever helps us find the culprit. Now, I said to myself, holy Moses, Ray, what's going on here? Julian never, ever, ever talks about his sources. And here he is all but saying Seth Rich gave him the information about the DNC emails, which, you know, this is important here. Let me just kind of parenthetically throw in here. Why were the DNC emails so important? Well, because the content of those emails indicated beyond reasonable doubt that the DNC, Debbie Wasserman Schultz and her crowd, five of whom quit the next day after they were revealed, they revealed that Bernie Sanders was cheated out of the nomination, the Democratic nomination. Pure and simple, clear. And how did the Russians get in? Well, here's how they get in. I know this. 2 days before the Democratic National Convention was to take place is when Julian Assange decided to release these emails. Were they authentic? Of course they were. No one even throws any doubt on that. So what was the problem? Well, they revealed what I just said, that Hillary cheated Sanders out of the nomination. So what are they going to do? 2 days before, oh, my God, you know, so they have a council of war here. And say, my God, what's Bernie going to do? Oh, my God, holy, and the convention is too, oh, so what do we do? Well, somebody says, well, I know what we do. We blame it on the Russians. And somebody else said, come on, it's not the Russians, it's Julian Assange. Well, yeah, we could say that Julian Assange worked with the Russians. And then they said, well, that's beginning to make some sense, but what would be the rationale? Oh, come on. The rationale is that Putin certainly prefers to have Donald Trump as president to Hillary Clinton. Now, Gene, whatever the other parts of that syllogism are, that major premise that Vladimir Putin would look at Donald Trump during the campaign, number one, realize that he, quote, never could win, okay, end quote. Number two, that he's not only unpredictable, but he brags about it, right? And number three, he lashes out at the slightest slight or real or imagined. He just lashes, he's completely reckless. So you're Vladimir Putin, right? And you're saying, wow, this guy is really an odd duck. That's precisely the kind of guy that I would like to have his fingers on the nuclear codes across the ocean. Oh, I mean, this is going to be great. You give me a break. You know, I've been watching Russian leaders for 54 years now, professionally in this town. And I can tell you that it's very, very strange. Those who argue that Vladimir Putin would have preferred Trump in the first place, particularly, as I said before, when it was a done deal that Hillary was going to win, everybody thought that, unless Putin is clairvoyant as well as a pretty adroit politician, he would have thought that too. And what are the percentages of messing around in the DNC, hacking into their system, and almost certainly be caught? Well, you know, so the whole premise fell apart, but that's how this Russian thing started. Now, getting back to Julian Assange and Seth Rich, this is the important part of all this. The Russians didn't hack the DNC, or maybe they tried to, like 50 other places tried to, but the damning, in quotes, email that had Cyrillic on it, in my view, the evidence is pretty clear now, that was not from the Russians. That was from John Brennan and the fantastic capability he has with the cyber folks to hack into places, disguise his own hacking, and attribute it to other people. They call it in the CIA documents that WikiLeaks has now released, they call it, quote, obfuscation, end quote. That's what they say. You obfuscate the person or the entity that hacked in. So here we have Seth Rich, and he works for the DNC, and he is said by Julian Assange to, Julian Assange says, well, this fellow, you know, this shows the risks that whistleblowers. So I'm saying to myself, my God, why would Julian do that? And then I said, well, Ray, come on. The guy's dead, right? I mean, Seth Rich is dead and gone a week ago. Why not reveal your sources? Well, turns out I was right. It was a no-brainer. But, you know, a guy who's robbed and then they forget to take his wallet or his watch or his $2,000 necklace, something smells there. Now we have these reports that the D.C. police were told, look, don't do a thorough investigation here. We'll take the computer. The FBI has it. And now it looks like it's going to come clear. What was it? What really happened? And that is that it was, as we suggested, that is Bill Binney from NSA, who knows all these things, who we suggested pretty much 90% back in January that this was a leak, not a hack. And now we know that the leak, in my view, almost certainly came from Seth Rich or some of his colleagues. Now, look at them. They were probably all big supporters of Bernie Sanders. Now, they took a look at the content of those emails and said, oh, my God, you know, this is unconscionable. I'm working for an outfit that's, oh, my God, but somebody's got to know about this. So they plug a little thumb drive into their machine, and you know the rest of the story. So the notion that the Russians were responsible for a leak, and when in reality, I'm sorry, the Russians were responsible for a hack, when in reality it was a leak, not only falls down, but now I think, I'm pretty sure, we know that that suspected hack was not the work of Vladimir Putin, but was the work of John Brennan and the people working with him to obfuscate these things in a manner, well, in an unprecedented manner, given the level of technology that's required to do it this way.
Yeah, no, for sure. Well, I think it seems that one thing that it's certainly the media and others are forgetting, it seems like the stakes here are extraordinarily high. I mean, obviously, the U.S. and Russia are major players in many parts of the world. The cooperation over Syria, you know, the hundreds of thousands of lives at stake. Obviously, the issue of nuclear war. Obviously, the issues on the Korea Peninsula, where both countries are part of the six-party talks. I mean, on so many different levels, it seems like this, you know, sort of link Trump to Russia thing, you know, whatever the veracity of any particular claim, that the end result here is that it's making it very difficult for there to be any discussion over where the United States and Russia could be cooperating more productively, because to even suggest anything positive in terms of U.S.-Russia cooperation now is to become some sort of, you know, secret Kremlin agent trying to destroy America.
That's right, Gene. And against that, you have a president who thumbs his nose at all this, who welcomes Sergei Lavrov into the White House, tells him stories, is pictured laughing and back-clapping, for which the president is very much under criticism by the mainstream press. Russians laughing, clapping, inviting them into the White House? They could be spies. One of the pundits described Kislyak, the Russian ambassador, as the top spy in the United States. Ambassadors aren't spies. They got about 100 spies working under them, but they never know what they're doing. Anyhow, what's going on here is that Trump is erratic. He often shoots himself in the foot, but he was elected. He was elected president. Now, my colleagues and I have this thing about honesty, okay? If you want to get rid of Trump, well, there are legal ways to do that. Impeachment is the name of the game. You do that, but you don't do that by falsifying evidence, all right? We have this abhorrence for for perjury or for tilting evidence or fixing the intelligence around the policy, as happened on Iraq. And so if you're going to get rid of Trump, do it honestly. Don't accuse him of playing cozy with the Russians when there is zero And I'll repeat that. There is zero evidence except for pictures of them laughing together, except for all these incredibly circumstantial pieces of evidence which don't hold water. The line is drawn now. Trump has fired Comey. Why? In my view, because Comey was part of this cabal with John Brennan and with NSA. Why do I say that? Well, look at Comey testifying before the House Intelligence Committee. He says with great discomfort. Now I know we didn't get access to the computers there in the DNC, and it would have been better. Of course, everybody acknowledges that to do forensics, you should have direct physical access, but we didn't get the physical access. We had to depend on the forensics from CrowdStrike. Now, here's the deal. CrowdStrike has not invested billions of dollars in trying to figure out viruses and hacking and stuff. NSA and CIA did. So it was a very, very sophisticated program that exceeded any capability CrowdStrike finding out about it. How about the FBI? Well, you know, they've got technicians that are pretty highly trained. They're not as good as the NSA ones, but if Comey would have said, as he should have, as he's embarrassed at having not had done this, if he said, look, seize those computers. I want you technicians to take a good physical look at them. Tell me what you find. Well, if Comey had done that, the chances are very great that his technicians would have said, oh, Mr. Comey, you won't believe. You won't believe the sophistication of the program that allows whoever's hacking to obfuscate the origin of the hack and blame it on somebody else. You know, we can't figure it out. Do you want us to go check with the NSA? Oh, God. So Comey would have had to say, no, don't do that. Why? Because it would have blown this operation that, as I say, CIA and NSA had worked out over a period of 15 years. There are 700 million lines of code in it. What does that mean? Well, each line of code costs $25. Do the math, okay? So this is a deep state. This is something that Trump has taken on. And one of the bizarre manifestations of this is that when Chuck Schumer, who is the ranking Democrat in the Senate now, was with Rachel Maddow early in January, he said, you know, I used to think Trump was a pretty bright guy, but he's done something very foolish. And she said, what's that? Well, he's taken on the CIA, and the CIA has six ways to Sunday to get at you. I thought he was a smart businessman, but he's done something very, very foolish. Now, what did Rachel say? Well, what she didn't say was what any person should have said. Mr. or Senator Schumer, are you saying that the President of the United States should be afraid of the CIA? Is that that what you're saying? She didn't say that, but that's what he said, okay? Now, you know, giving hypocrisy a bad name, Schumer is leading the charge for an independent prosecutor. Give me a break. So, bottom line here, Trump has taken on the deep state. I don't know who's going to win. I do know that in a bizarre sense that Schumer is right, that most presidents have been afraid of taking on the intelligence community. And if Trump insists on doing that, well, maybe Schumer will turn out to have been right, and Trump will have proven to have done something very foolish. We'll have to see. You know, it's really the denouement is coming, and it's coming quicker than anyone thought, I think, because they realize that if they don't blacken Trump beyond repair, what's Trump going to do? He's going to get his people in places where they can dish out all this stuff on Brennan and say, look, this is what happened.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's very, very prescient points. As always, that's where we're going to have to leave it. We're going to come back here after another break on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. Thanks to Ray McGovern. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
North Cat, baby, I'm a boss. Yeah. Carolina barbecue sauce with the slaw. I'm the safe, the seller, and the vault. I'm the best, the effect, and the cause, I'm the law.
And that was G. Yamazawa with North Cack featuring Joshua Gunn and Kane Smigo off of his debut album, Shouts to Durham. And here to talk more about the new album is G. Yamazawa himself. Thank you, sir, for joining the show.
Thank you for having me, man. It's great to be here.
No, of course, of course. And so your new album making big moves on the iTunes charts. Hopefully people will go and check it out after they listen to this. But tell us a little bit about what you're doing with this album, what people will find, and a little bit of maybe what you were hoping to convey.
So, yeah, so the album is out now. It's called Shouts to Durham. It's my debut LP. You know, I've been, you know, rapping since I was like 12, 13. And doing spoken word heavily since I was 14 for my teenage years. But this is the first sort of real, I think, record I've ever really put together. And I put together an EP last year, but it was like really heady, you know, it was like really dense and kind of just, I focused a lot on the poetics rather than kind of the writability factor. And, you know, growing up in North Carolina, we're big on like subwoofer culture, you know, so I had a little truck, a two-door truck, and had a 12-inch subwoofer in my back seat that my driver's seat was leaned up against. So I like grew up loving bass. So, you know, this project, I really wanted something that people could like just throw on their car and just ride to. And I think it does a job, man. I think it's one of those kind of, you could just throw it in the whip and ride out to it. And I tour heavily as well. And so I'm always in the car driving from place to place. And I wanted something that people could really bang in their car, but also sort of not compromise their own moral sense of alignment, you know. And yeah, just dope beats, dope rhymes, and kind of I felt like I finally found like the sound that I always imagined. And I think for every artist, it's difficult to really find your voice, find your sound. And I think I've finally kind of got my first jab at that. So it's been exciting for sure.
No, for sure. Absolutely. Absolutely. And coming out of Durham, North Carolina, quite the North Carolina renaissance happening right now in the hip hop world. But that's
man,
a whole
beautiful.
J. Cole, yeah, everybody, yeah. People he's yeah. bringing up. I'm old enough to still remember when like P.D. Pablo set it off, you know, take your shirt off, roll around your head like a helicopter.
Oh, man.
But nevertheless, yeah. man, I feel like you have such an interesting story. I mean, you know, your parents are Japanese immigrants. You're coming from the South. I don't really think anybody, most people in America who aren't from the South really associate, you know, Asian Americans with the American South. And I'm just curious from your perspective, I mean, how much of the work that you do is also really kind of ambassadorial in some sense of bringing a lot of those things to the forefront, bringing that culture, that history. And I mean, just the fact that, you know, you exist as a person with other people in that space that you're doing sort of in not only your music, but especially in your shows and poetry.
Well, it's very interesting, you know. So I've been touring pretty heavily for the last few years, and oftentimes, you know, it's easy to think like it's a real diverse country when you're in these big cities or whatever. But I've gone, you know, I've been able to travel to a lot of like rural America, which is very reminiscent of how I grew up as well. But I kind of realized within the last few years, like a lot of America, just in general, kind of really has never seen an Asian American person speak confidently, even much less on a stage, much less sort of, you know, speaking to their experiences wherever they grew up. And sort of, you know, America is like the king of propaganda and the king of sort of making you view a certain type of person a certain type of way. And I think for most minority groups, you know, not only are we like underrepresented, but also very much so misrepresented. And so I think, you know, the spoken word aspect of kind of, you know, my art, you know, has allowed me to just be able to confidently share my story and understand sort of how much value that has in and of itself. And many times, you know, growing up, like I just always felt like an alien, like just a straight up, right. straight up alien, like no one's ever seen anything like me. And, you know, I think even deeper than just that sort of regular point is sort of having this Southern background and sort of being able to like embody the kind of harmony that I was able to experience growing up in North Carolina as well. And I think, you know, not only is our Asian Americans misrepresented, also Southern folk and Southern culture is also very misrepresented in mainstream media as well, viewed as highly uneducated, viewed as sort of not being able to add any sort of like substance to this, you know, a fast-paced moving society that we're a part of now. But I think, you know, if there's anything I've learned about being in the South and being and just from a small town in general, is kind of just finding the beauty, you know, in life and seeing things grow and the stars. I mean, all of these little things in life that I've learned to build a deep appreciation for. I think I hope to embody in my work. And, you know, you've seen a little bit of like Asian Americans represented in hip hop, but not as much. And especially spoken word in and of itself is also a very sort of underground, you know, art form in America right now as well. So I think when people see me on stage, they're just like, holy, people just have never seen nothing like it. And I think that's, I've learned that that actually is very powerful as well.
Yeah.
Just the way it is. And so, yeah, it's definitely been an interesting road and journey. And, but you know, I'm used to it. I'm used to it. You know, growing up, like, you know, white folks would be like, why is this Asian kid acting black? And then naturally, righteously, you know, black folk also be like, yo, why is this kid acting black? You know, or and it's just very, you know, natural for, I think, a lot of folks in the black community to kind of immediately sort of, you know, question or be concerned with whether I'm being true to who I am. And I found in most cases that once people sort of get to know me or talk to me or sort of understand where I come from, they see that it's, you know, I'm actually being myself and I'm actually being very sincere and walking with respect into any community that I encounter in.
I think it's a great point. Now, I'm glad you raised the issue of representation because I've always felt like it's especially now with all the conversation that I'm glad we're finally having about Asian American representation in movies, especially in television, and you know, a lot of the cultural appropriation. It's always sort of this weird reality where on the one hand, America tries to hold up Asian Americans as the quote unquote model minority. But I've also felt that like the flip side of that coin is it's sort of like, since we're holding you up as this exemplary thing, then it's like still cool to be racist towards Asians in popular culture. Like, for instance, Silicon Valley on HBO, it's a good show, it's a funny show, but you know, 2 episodes ago, one of the things, one of the little sort of subtextual jokes is a white guy speaking fake Mandarin. And I thought, like, man, if you had a white dude on television with like a black guy doing a pitch in Silicon Valley and he tried to do some sort of like Ebonics, like people would be, the show would be almost off the air midweek, but like it's funny. If it's an Asian immigrant, you know, and I think it's just an interesting space.
I mean, even Steve Harvey and the what was it, the Grammys or Oscars, Chris Rock. I mean, clearly, you know, Asian Americans are still a punchline, and many like minority groups are still a punchline. And honestly, man, I kind of get it. You know, I'm big on sort of really looking at past, present, and future, and trying to see the whole totality of time. And how sort of different causes have manifested this effect. And you know, what's beautiful now, though, is like this internet generation is really changing that, man. The YouTube generation, people are really starting to be able to tell their own stories their own way at a very high, like, production value. And, you know, things like Fresh Off the Boat really pop. I mean, I think there's a lot of exciting things happening right now. And they're happening right now as we speak. And, you know, in response to all the things that we're seeing. So it's for me, I think it's a really beautiful, an exciting time for Asian American artists, especially. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. And I think an exciting time for people who are trying to do some, I mean, I hate to even use the phrase like politically conscious art. Like, I feel like it's been so perpetuated. But I think speaking to your opening point about trying to produce something that people could enjoy listening to without having to feel like maybe they had compromised themselves. And I'm curious how you are seeing this, because obviously this is something that you've done for some time. And I know that you also work with Split This Rock that does a great job putting these out. Shout out to my man Joseph, who I know listens to the show. You know, and it just seems like, I wonder how as an artist you feel like, is it like, man, finally people are catching up and getting a new appreciation for what I've been trying to put out there because they've woken up a little bit? Or is it a little bit like, man, I've been out here, but now I'm getting so much more shine because, you know, people have woken up or whatever. I mean, I wonder how you fit it in there.
I mean, man, it's kind of, I think as an artist, all of us sort of struggle with the push and pull of saying what you want to say and also in relationship to what you feel like people want to hear or don't want to hear. And so it's a really difficult sort of line to try to like teeter between. I personally always try to like start with what is it that I really, me, George Yamazawa Jr. needs to say, and sort of allow that to kind of navigate how I'm going to approach each track or each song, or each just piece of writing. And like, I don't know, I try to focus less on what it is that I feel like the world wants or needs in a sense. And it's mostly about what I really need to say. And so you know, when it comes to like Trump resistance, like, man, for me, it's just like, there's no way I could be making music or making art and putting it into the world without addressing what's going on right now. And I think, you know, I guess it's fortunate that, you know, people are also taking to that as well. But man, I mean, for me, I'm just like, I can't imagine an artist sort of not wanting to improve upon silence, right? Like don't speak unless it improves upon silence. And so I it's always just been much more of an interpersonal, introspective kind of process. And it's just crazy right now, man, you know? And I think as an art, you know, I think we all have very unique paths towards like this flow of peace, this flow of resistance. And my personal path happens to be art. It happens to be hip hop. It happens to be this black dominated culture. And so for me, I think there were many things that I needed to address, which was my own, what it's like to be an Asian American in a black art form and culture, first and foremost, and also sort of addressing police brutality and addressing issues that sort of plague the black community. And then sort of the larger issue of Donald Trump and what the political climate right now that we're in. And yeah, man, I mean, it's just definitely, it's been killing me, man. I mean, it's been killing all of us, you know? It's just, it's like, yo, what do we do, man? What can this one person possibly do? And if I can make a song that can invigorate somebody and make them feel riled up and fired up to say, yo, Donald Trump, man, like, I'm going to do something that can help, and I'm going to play this song in the background while I do that. That's kind of, I think, where I saw myself fitting into this flow.
Mm. And you know, I mentioned this just a little bit, but, you know, I'm thinking about, you know, this sort of the institutional organizational piece, groups like Split This Rock and Empowering Young People. I know the Dream Defenders down in Miami, it's opened up a studio there where they're bringing in young folks and giving them access to music and culture. A group I work close with here in DC, 1DC, doing the same thing where they're doing like a time bank where you can get free studio time for doing some organizing and so on and so forth. But I think so often we think about quote unquote at-risk youth, although I hate that phrase. And it's just like, how do we get them a job? How do we get them an education? And nobody really looks at, you know, cultural work in some ways as being an important reality and not only empowering young people and giving them alternatives, but something that's actually close to a lot of what they really do care about, and how so much of, I think, our society is like, you know, go in these paths that we say are like the way to go, and not like, let's try to find a way to help you, you know, monetize, or even if it's not monetized, at least, you know, find a big role in cultural and personal expression. So talk about the importance of programs like that and ideas and concepts like that when we're thinking about some of those who I think are often deemed as the throwaways of our society.
Well, so a bit about my background, you know, I got expelled from high school when I was a junior and went to an alternative school and sort of kind of really firsthand saw what happens once sort of different systems like forget about you or sort of deem you unworthy, right? And I, you know, poetry and that community was not only hip hop, but mostly definitely poetry was that community that allowed me to self-actualize my dreams, and it allowed me to sort of find empowerment in my voice itself. And I think, and so, you know, in North Carolina, we helped start one of the founding youth poetry organizations called Sacrificial Poets. And when I moved to Washington, D.C., I worked very closely with Split This Rock as well. And so I've always been very, like, invested in the youth and upbringing that generation. And I think when people think about going back to that point of, like, what is my unique way in order to help change society, I've definitely been very invested in sort of youth advocacy. And, you know, youth need to feel like this whole system is made to just sort of create little machines and not promote sort of self-thought and thinking for yourself and asking questions. And so for me, I think poetry is all kind of, and the arts in general is like the science of the heart, you know, and it's the science of sort of how you feel and how you're able to self-actualize yourself. And so, yeah, I think it's extremely important to not only fight these issues firsthand right now, but also thinking about how we're affecting sort of the younger generation and allowing them to think for themselves and allowing them to to think about new creative ways to sort of change the society that they live in and their realities.
And, you know, how much is new media, streaming services and the like, from your perspective, kind of changing the way hip hop is both consumed and distributed? I mean, I think that, you know, the obviously big players still have a lot of influence, maybe different players, but sort of the breakdown of the studio system and the need to be signed to a label to get yourself out there. Not that people shouldn't, but you know what I'm saying? There's so many more different ways and so many more different people who I think are blown from alternative way of getting in people's face, not necessarily the video, radio, payola rotation.
Well, I think there's always sort of the oneness, you know, of like of pro and con, of good and bad. In one sense, sort of people are able to start their own careers and create their own music at their own pace and their own sort of plan and strategy. But I feel sort of, you know, I'm oftentimes like really overwhelmed by social media, man. I get on there. And it's just like this, like you step into this world of just like all of these opinions and not as many reflections. And I think a lot of people are, like, you know, attention spans are so much shorter now, which I think it makes it a lot more difficult for artists to kind of capture an audience. And just sort of, there's all this content, man. There's just every day, like amazing albums are dropping, amazing videos are dropping. You're getting different news but I think that, like, I try my best to focus on the most positive aspects of everything that I encounter. And I think it mostly for me, I think, is an exciting time for artists and the industry and sort of artists reclaiming their power and influence and reach and sort of how the record labels really aren't that big of an issue anymore. You don't need to go through them. And Chance is a beautiful example of that. And of course, that's like kind of the supreme pinnacle example. But, you know, I think ultimately I feel that I've gained a lot of power in my hands when I'm creating something and when I'm putting content out there in the world.
No, absolutely. I mean, and it seems like it gives more of a real an ability to sort of create ecosystems of artists around you that can sort of come up then behind, and you don't have to be, you know, think it's not the same relationship even between like new artists emerging as well. It's not like everyone, I'm gonna start a little label and try to sign 15 people. It's easier to imagine how you can just give exposure to people and let it rise. So I'm curious now, looking into this, we got a minute left. You know, tell folks where they can get the album, where they can procure it, where they can learn about your shows. How can people follow you, basically?
Word. So the first and foremost, I mean, you can check out the website at gyamazawa.com. All my social media handles are gyamazawa. If you could spell Yamazawa, you know, you should be able to find me, which might be the most difficult part. but yeah, you know, my YouTube is very phonetic. It's G and it's Y-A-M-A-Z-A-W-A. The album Shouts to Durham is available on all major streaming platforms. Going to be dropping a lot more videos and sort of visual content on my Facebook page and YouTube as well. It's a really exciting time. And I really, really appreciate y'all for having me on here, for sure.
Nah, man, we're happy to have you and definitely hoping that everybody goes out and checks it out. G Yamazawa, Y-A-M-A-Z-A-W-A. That could be like a little piece of a song right there.
I'm working on it.
Okay, there we go. So definitely check him out, follow him, listen to the album, go to his shows, do the whole nine. We were really, really blessed to have you on the show today. That is going to do it for us here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I am your host, Eugene Puryear. See you next time.
By Any Means Necessary.